The reason that we can do the job we do is because when you set someone on fire or you drop rocks from the ceiling, the hazard is obvious. So we're all working on that. Sometimes then that means that the things around the outside of that we maybe don't pay as much attention to, and because they don't seem to be, you know, I'm talking about perhaps wellness, people's working hours and everything that goes into that. But we're really good at creating these absolutely incredible things. I mean, I've part of the career I had working with the company that produced Warhorse, you know, there was a moment where we had an actor run and take a jump onto a puppet horse that was held up by two other people and then canter across the stage and then get shot at and fall off the horse. You know, that's the sort of thing that we can make happen.
That was Anna Glover, who joins Brian Honeycutt in the latest episode of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome back, or welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo, your host. If you're a regular listener, you know the drill. We go long form on risk and uncertainty across all topics and domains. And my sincere wish for all of you through these conversations is that you learn some ways in which you can embrace uncertainty and look at the world in a different and better way. And that goes for myself as well. Before we get into what is an awesome episode, business as usual, this episode is brought to you by Audible, the home for audiobooks. I love Audible as a platform and I use it regularly. And as a listener to the podcast, you can get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook, which is yours to keep no matter what. To take advantage of this, simply go to audibletrial.com/allthingsrisk if you are in the United States. If you are in the UK, click on the link in the show notes. All right. This episode was a bit of an experiment and a very successful one at that. This was our first live recording with an audience, and it took place a few weeks ago in Louisville, Kentucky, in the United States at the USITT conference. USITT is the US Institute for Theater Technology, and that aims to advance the skills and technology of theater, entertainment, and the performing arts and design. And basically, if you think about live shows that might have things like fireworks or crazy lighting and sound and special effects and amazing stunts and all of those other things, then you are not far off. Now, what's interesting about all of that is that in many ways, these types of shows, live theater, they are pushing boundaries and trying all sorts of new things. If you've been to the theater lately or you've been to a live show at a theme park, you know about that. And what that also means is that those types of things are full of risk and uncertainty. And that means an open door for some amazing insights. And that's exactly what we have for you in this episode. My guests are Anna Glover and Brian Honeycutt. And if you are a longtime listener to the show, you'll remember Anna was my guest on episode 10, and she is currently the director of occupational health and wellness at the Yale University School of Drama. And Brian works in entertainment safety at Disney, Walt Disney. Both do very cool jobs. They help directors and those involved in live theater and shows do some amazing things and do those things safely. And we have a fascinating conversation that covers all of that, including some very insightful audience questions. So we get into a range of really cool stuff, things like what to do when something goes wrong, organizational culture and speaking up, why you should ask questions you already know the answers to, how to speak up and speak truth to power, which is quite an important skill, how to learn from mistakes, and so much more. There are a number of wonderful takeaways here that apply to all types of domains and endeavors. So let's get into it. Here are Anna Glover and Brian Honeycutt. So, Brian, Anna, welcome, and everyone here, welcome to the All Things Risk podcast.
this is really cool, but this is different. So I'm big on taking risks and experiments. So this is exactly what this is. Before we get into a few topics, it'd be very cool if both of you just introduce yourselves. And when you get asked that terrible question, what is it that you do? How do you answer that question?
So actually, Ben, this is my second time on your podcast, and I'm really delighted to be back. I'm Anna Glover, and the official job title is the Director of Theatre and Occupational Health for the Yale School of Drama and the Yale Repertory Theatre, which is different from what I was doing last time. The unofficial title is Safety Unicorn, which is...
Okay, you're going to have to explain that now.
So essentially, when people think of safety, they think of people that are trying to stop something from happening. And the world I live in, if that was my approach to my job, I would very quickly be out of a job. The safest theatre would probably be continually doing Waiting for Godot with just two chairs on a stage. We could do that once or twice, but we'd soon lose our audience. So we're looking at pushing boundaries, and particularly in the world we work in, the people we work with are always being creatives, creating new things. So we're constantly looking at how we approach those and make those things happen safely. The reason I say safety unicorn is because in our industry, there are not many people like me. You've got two of us on the show who are actively working with people to try and make that happen. So we're taking a skill set, which is an understanding of risk and understanding of safety, and applying it to people that want to do things like set fire to themselves or use lasers or blow things up and do it over and over again in front of large audiences.
Right.
So yeah, that's the answer.
You have a cool job.
Yeah.
And that was only 2 minutes of answer, which is great for that, this kind of question. I'm not after the people that just say like the one word answer, because that's boring, right? So we want interesting conversation. So Brian, when you get asked that question, cocktail party, what do you do, Brian?
My name is Brian Honeycutt. My official job title is I am the Cast Preparation and Incident Response Program Manager for Disney Parks Live Entertainment. So that's a lot of words to basically say we take care of performers, we take care of cast and crew, all of the disciplines that are part of making the magic come to life in a theme park environment. So really, much of what Anna was saying, our role is to make sure that everyone goes home in the condition that they showed up to work in. So, and as the safety unicorns, you know, one of the reasons we love that phrase is there are very few of us that have that singular focus of taking care of folks. I'm very lucky to be in a place where my job is to care. My job is to care about people, to make sure that they're well taken care of. And in the theater world, the theatrical space, it very often is you have a technical director who also has to look at safety. You have a stage manager who also has to look at safety. And so we're very fortunate to be those unicorns and can have that singular focus and look at safety from a spectrum that gives us the ability to help those people solve their problems and still deliver what they want. Yes, we can do Waiting for Godot with two chairs, but someone will eventually fall out of one of those two chairs, and even there, we'll figure out a way to insert risk into a seemingly safe environment.
Right, right. So for both of you, is this what you dreamt of doing? How did you get into this?
Absolutely not. I mean, I went to a very ordinary school, and when I went to see the careers advisor, the careers advisor said to me, you know, what are you interested in? And at the time, I was passionately interested in science. They said, okay, we live in a small town with a pharmaceutical company. Probably your best bet is to try and find a job with a pharmaceutical company. I wanted to be a marine biologist for a long time, and then I wanted to be a writer, and then I just didn't know what I wanted to do. But I remember one day that I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And I had this sense of just not realizing it was kind of university, where I got an English degree, which qualifies you for nothing except telling stories. And then it basically was like black hole, what next? And I was actually working as a climbing wall instructor and route builder. And I happened to go and see a stage show in London. I was taking some time off and I went down to London. And I remember sitting down and the lights went down, and I took a breath in, and I think I let that breath out at the end of that performance. And for the whole of it was a 90-minute, all the way through, straight through, very physical piece of theatre. And I was just blown away by what I saw. And I felt like a physical, it was like falling in love with something. And I didn't want to perform. I wanted to get involved in what was happening on the stage. And there was things like glass cubes falling down from the sky and ladders and, you know, these amazing... it was a set designed by Tom Pye, and he was great with you know, his projections and all sorts of other things. So the whole thing was just incredible. Mm. And so I thought, I have to change my direction. I'll do anything. And I basically got in as a person of all trades. I did some lighting. I did some stage management. I did a tiny bit of production management.
How did you get your kind of foot in the door?
In that
world, what did you do?
I wrote a lot of letters to a lot of places, but I wrote one of those terrible letters that you get when you work in theatre from people, which says, "I want to work in theatre. I'll do anything," which means we don't know where to put you. And what I've learned since then is, if you want to work in theatre, find a thing that you're good at and offer to do that for the people. Mm. And that is the way to get your foot in the door. I can build things. I can hang things. I'm good with something. And then they know what to do with you. So eventually I got an answer from the National Theatre, and they said, we're looking for backstage tour guides. If you want to come and talk about the show in front of us, we'll give you an audition. And so I did that. And then I was invited to join the backstage tour team. And the good thing about that job is they asked you to interview all the people that worked, so you could start translating that to the public. And essentially, that's a skill set that I've carried on in my career, translating the complicated stuff that goes on behind the scenes to people like OSHA inspectors or other inspectors who want to get in the way and try and stop that from happening, because they don't understand how much care goes on.
Mm.
And then one day they offered me a chance to do health and safety, and they said, "We're looking for a trainee. Would you like to do that? You seem really keen." And I thought, that is a terrible idea. nobody wants to sit at a bar with someone who does health and safety. But actually, because I love theatre so much, perhaps I can be someone that changes that perception. And that, gosh, was about 15 years ago. So, yeah.
That's very cool, because I also think that when I hire people in my role, and I always find you can trip yourself up hiring the wrong person just by going through only an interview, right? And an interview is just, it's just, you're measuring how great the person can interview, but there are some wonderful people that, you know, that might not pass the sort of interview test. You need to get them to do the thing that the job's about. Otherwise, how do you know? So if you offer to do that, then I think that's a great strategy for any career.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Brian.
So I'm not a similar pathway at all. I was the bratty performer from a very young age. So I was always the kid who wanted to do the singing, the dancing, watching the Gene Kelly movies, trying to memorize the dance steps, and the little boy in tap and running around doing all that stuff. So that then translated into being every stage manager's nightmare, as I wanted to do all of the things, touch all of the props, and do all of that stuff. And there was this TV show that was on, I'm going to go with the 80s, 90s, that's probably a bad estimate, but it's called The Fall Guy. And it's, he's awesome, a stuntman.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to become a stuntman. So that translates into, you know, learning all of the different gymnastics and doing all of those things and learning the stunt work world. And so that then translates into, you become a cheerleader in college, you learn some of those things, and after you go to college and realize, oh, I need to graduate at some point, what am I going to do now? I'll go to this little theme park in Florida, maybe work for a summer. So I wound up going to that little theme park in Florida, getting my summer job, wound up performing the parades, driving floats, walking on stilts, being a puppeteer, eventually becoming a leader in the company. And about 25 years later, I'm still doing that summer job.
Hmm.
So, and the way I moved into the role that I'm in now, basically, Anna and I were actually talking about this earlier today, is I was a parade manager in the Magic Kingdom, the most magical place on Earth, especially around parade time. And
what's Mickey Mouse really like?
Fantastic. Fantastic guy. Always on time for every single cue. Can't mess him up. Always remembers his lines perfectly. So we're in the midst of a very rainy day in Florida, mm-hmm. and sending out these very, very complicated parades and having a park duty manager who's in charge of basically the entire park. And standing in front of the person who is the final responsible person in that and telling them that it's not safe to send the parade out with thousands of guests waiting for this parade because of how heavy the floats are, the difficulty for the drivers to see, and making that decision and really pushing against that person and saying, I can't give it to you right now. We have another one scheduled in an hour. Can I cancel the first one, get the second one there? And they're like, no, we have to send it out. But basically pushing back on that person. And about a year and a half later, he hired me because I was one of the only folks who would stand up to him and tell him what he needed to hear instead of what he wanted to hear. Mm. And I think sometimes that's where we find ourselves in the world of safety, is making sure we can translate what someone needs to hear and especially how they need to hear
it. Can we spend a little time on that?
Absolutely.
Because I think as people certainly in my profession in risk, that's something I have to do. But I think throughout our lives, we have to do that at certain points. Tell people that we care about or that we respect or that could cost us our jobs, that they need to hear something they don't want to hear. How do you do that? What's your approach to that?
I think the most thing, you see the phrase authentic leadership. Mm-hmm. And I think the authenticity is the key piece of that, more so than the leadership portion of that. And I think building that trust with folks over time, and making sure that they understand what your goals are and that your goals are to give them the product that they're looking for. Mm-hmm. So often we're looking at creative product and being able to deliver that creative product with the vision that is behind it. So how do I take that vision and tell them the story, mm-hmm. of how doing it a different way can still deliver the vision that the way they want? So understanding from, I don't want to focus on codes. I don't want to focus on laws. I don't want to focus on those things. I want to focus on the story. What we do is tell stories. So telling that story in the most pure form I can tell it, and then making sure that we can do that in a way that we minimize the risk. To your point, you know, the word safe has all kinds of connotations. And a lot of times I think we look at safety and say, we've got to make it safe. We've got to make it safe. And the reality is that there's always risk in certain things. So I have to manage the risk the best way we possibly can. And I have to help people understand those moments where they might be uncomfortable, mm-hmm. with something, but it's not unsafe. So how do I help you become comfortable with that thing so that you understand all the work that has gone into making sure that you will be able to perform the task, do the stunt, do the effect in such a way that we've managed the risk to a level that you're going to be okay?
Mm-hmm. A couple things I heard you say that I think resonate into other spaces. One is this trust, right? So you need to have a trusting relationship with the person that you're speaking to. And I think then the second thing is putting yourself in their shoes, right? Coming at it from, you know, their vantage point, that, you know, you don't want to be the person that on their watch that something, you know, horrific went, you know, happened, right? And I think that's really powerful stuff that I think people can take away for other contexts, that when you're trying to deliver some difficult news, is, yeah, you've got to have some trust and put yourself in their shoes, and then try and, you know, tell the story in that way. And it's never easy, right? But Yeah, that's quite interesting.
Well, you said something today, Ben, that really resonated with me, and you were talking about what makes a good risk manager. And actually, one of the things you said was being a good psychologist, and I think that's absolutely what works in the profession that we have. Mm-hmm. Brian and I, we will talk about safety, but actually, risk is a much much more comfortable phrase, because safe has two states: mm-hmm. safe or unsafe. People find it difficult to have right. degrees of safety, because that's a very uncomfortable position for people to be in. And if you're having a discussion with the director and you're talking about those two states, an artistic director won't say, make that unsafe for me. Mm. But they might say, we don't want it to be too safe, because that might be boring. If you talk about risk, you open up a whole other lexicon that you can use, and you can talk about degrees of risk, or mm-hmm. putting the risk where it needs to be. But to take them on that journey, you do need to understand that person. So it is about empathy, mm. but it's also about psychology, knowing mm. what condition they might be in, knowing how they feel about that show. Sometimes, that relationship starts, months before you get to that moment of mm. decision, with a cup of coffee, or reading the script and meeting them, with an idea of the language that they're using, starting mm-hmm. with, I'm excited to work with you on this project. Mm-hmm. The first time, I don't know if this happens to you, Brian, but when the first time we're in a design presentation and you hear a creative person talk about what it is they want to achieve, the last thing you ever start doing is saying, well, you can't do that because, or that's going right. to cost you that much because.
Right.
The first words out of your mouth should be, this is going to be an amazing project. I'm really glad I'm working mm-hmm. on it with you.
Right.
We always start from that place of, we want to say yes. And a friend of mine, I stole this phrase from him. He often referred to the work we do as, we're doing horticulture. Hmm. So we'll listen to that director, we'll listen to those folks, and then we'll plant that little seed. When we see that thing and we're like, oh, I don't know how we're going to do this, or I don't know how this is going to work, but we'll plant that little seed about, hey, I want to talk to you about this. I want to help figure it out. And then maybe if we come up with an idea, we go back to them and ask them a series of other questions. And I think when we do our jobs well, they come to us with our own idea, mm-hmm. and we get to tell them right. that it's great. Right. That's a brilliant idea that you've come up with. So I think it's important to give away your ideas mm-hmm. and not worry about who gets the credit. My father has a phrase that I love. It's you share the credit and accept the blame. So when people come up with those great things mm-hmm. and we've had those great conversations, and then they come back with this wonderful idea, which has probably grown immensely from the last time you've talked, because they've listened. Mm-hmm. And I think the best tool we have in the arsenal is that ability to listen to what those ideas are and then take some space. Don't solve it immediately. Don't look at, well, I know we have to do this. I know that this code applies. Take that time and walk away and look at it again and look at it from all angles and try to understand and say, well, can we do this? Can we not do this? Rail heights are a perfect example. OSHA is very clear what the rail height has to be.
So for my listeners, what is OSHA?
Okay, it's the Occupational okay. Health and Safety Administration, and I hope I said that right, and if I didn't, it is forever recorded. and basically, the laws and the guidelines that we deal with government agencies set what a standard handrail needs to be. Often when we're dealing with performers on parade floats, I don't want to put a handrail because it destroys the lines of vision. Mm. So we have to think about other things. There are places where we can do a handrail. But the logic behind the height of the handrail is based upon the center of gravity.
Okay.
So Mickey Mouse might be a little shorter than the average person. Mm. So the center of gravity changes. Mm. So if I know that the only person that's going to be up there is a little bit shorter, then I can probably get a variance to make that rail a little bit shorter. Right. But that means I have to be very, very strict in the administrative mm. controls of who goes up there. Mm. And if anyone over that height goes up there, then they have to be tied off and meet all the other things. But there's always a creative solution that might not be obvious at first glance. But then when you walk away, it's like, oh, wait a minute. This could work. Mm-hmm. So looking at things from a different lens often is the best way.
Mm. I think if you were, it would be like trying to teach a child how to write a sentence by giving them a dictionary. is how not to approach a project with code. So we have to get a child to write a sentence, you have to get them interested in telling stories and then want to come up with it on their own.
Right.
And then when it comes to a particular word, we've got this book that will help us get that word right.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't start with that.
No.
Because that's going to turn everyone off straight away. And so, as Brian said, it's kind of like, what is going on around all of that? And we'll get to the code. It's there if you mm-hmm. need it, but let's get that story.
Yeah, that's so important. Sometimes, all those codes, there's a spirit behind the code. So if you stick to the spirit of what the code is trying to do, then as a byproduct of that, then you'll comply. But if you start with just compliance, then, you will, I'm sure you'll piss off your stakeholders, get into a bureaucratic mess, and may not be able to, do the thing or help them do the things they want to do. Yeah,
and it's also interesting. I think we're very frightened of code as well. But essentially, it's supposed to be a guide, and it was decided on by people in a room based on some data. Right. Obviously, they didn't just say we want to have a railing this height, but they're just doing the best they can. So I think when you also humanize that code as well, it's not like here's a book of stuff that's going to help us figure this out. Mm. That was written by people that are also trying to figure it out,
right.
And all we're trying to do is. Is send people home in the same condition they turned up, so that we can do this stuff over and over again. But we're doing more and more advanced things, so it's not actually stopping anything from happening.
Mm.
I think we're very frightened of that word code. Like, what are you going to prevent?
Mm-hmm.
But I think we can humanize it.
Right. I have just a question for both of you around the work that you've done and what for both of you. What's the coolest thing you've worked on?
Well, I've had some pretty amazing opportunities through the years, but working at a place like the magical theme parks, you get to see a lot of celebrities, you get to meet a lot of folks, but I will definitely say that probably the most amazing moment for me was the first time I ever got to walk stilts in a parade. It's such a simple thing, but...
simple. Wait a minute.
it's actually easier than anyone might want you to believe. But in 1996, there was a parade called the Mickey Mania Parade, and the parade route, you make a turn, and coming onto Main Street USA, you see the entire crowd down the street, and it was really the first moment that, because the stilts were 5 foot tall, and I'm on top of that. I could literally see the entire crowd and could see everything. And it was just that moment that I was always a performer, always enjoyed that, always seen this. But it was just – that's the moment that sticks with me in my career of being, this is what I love. This is what I love doing. And I know I was going to finish that day absolutely exhausted. Mm-hmm. I know I was going to finish that day. My legs were going to be sore. But – it's just worth it. So I think that's the coolest thing.
Mm-hmm.
And having my family be able to see me do what I love is just, it's an amazing feeling.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah. I think the last time you asked me that question, I think I talked about setting someone on fire.
You did, yeah.
Which does remain a career high. But I want to introduce something else. And I have to be careful how I talk about this because I haven't actually asked permission. So I'll ask forgiveness. But the thing about safety is you work with people, right? So when I tell this story, I'm not saying that there's a huge team of people around that makes this thing happen. But we had a director who wanted to create a moment in a show where they felt that the characters on stage were being completely overwhelmed by huge hordes of an army, a foreign army that was coming in. And she had seen a video of someone playing with rocks and rocks falling from the sky and rocks being thrown, and wanted to have about 500 pounds of rocks dropped from the ceiling. And it was like, brilliant, how do we make that happen? Mm. And so you start with a problem like that, and the team that starts to figure out how to make that happen. But for me, the cool part was seeing some very senior people in the area going, that's a bad idea. We shouldn't do that.
Hmm.
And actually saying we can do this, and what's more, we're going to work the problem. So you start by saying, well, what are the knowns, right? Gravity, things always fall in a straight line down unless they're met with resistance. So what is it what is the effect we're trying to see? Do you want to see them fall? Yes. You want to hear the sound of them hitting? Yes. Do you care where they land after that? No. So we can then start working around that problem. Mm. And through all these steps, eventually we got to the point in the show where we were able to do this live and repeat it. And I remember sitting in the audience, knowing the steps that the people had taken to make this thing happen, watching this avalanche of rocks fall from the ceiling onto the stage, feeling the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end because the effect was amazing, and have people behind me kind of go, you know, wow, that was yeah. amazing. You let that happen. Mm. And, you know, I didn't. I brilliant people worked on that project. But it's one of those things where you've got this thing that looks unsafe, it feels unsafe, and people are asking, should we do it? And you know what? It was completely injury-free. It was one of the most amazing things I've worked on. So yes, setting someone on fire and dropping rocks from the ceiling.
And the funny thing is, when you talk about setting someone on fire, looking at all of the things that we've done in the parks over the years, setting someone on fire was one of the statistically safest things that we have ever done from a performance standpoint.
Really?
If I look at injuries of other things and how people have gotten hurt over the years, we had a show called Lights, Motors, Action where one of the performers crashes a motorcycle through a wall of fire, gets up, now they're on fire, and we put them out. We're going to do that multiple times per day. And everyone said yes to that. Mm. So much like Anna's experience with that is there's a safe way to light people on fire. Hmm. And I love saying that sentence because people immediately go, you just said there's a safe way to light people on fire. There are very few OSHA codes related to lighting people on fire. It is frowned upon. Uh-huh. But stopping and looking back at the work that goes into something like that, the checklists about the dressing procedures, all of the things that have to be done correctly and checked and double checked to get to that tiny moment. Mm-hmm. So much like the rocks, that's a small moment that happens, a very dramatic moment. But if we do our jobs correctly, the audience goes, wow, that was amazing, and never understands the level of work that goes into that moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I think you know the thing that I love about the industry we work in is we work with problem solvers, and you know the reason that we can do the job we do is because when you set someone on fire or you drop rocks from the ceiling, the hazard is obvious. So we're all working on that. Sometimes then that means that the things around the outside of that we maybe don't pay as much attention to, and because they don't seem to be, you know, I'm talking about perhaps wellness, people's working hours and everything that goes into that. But we're really good at creating these absolutely incredible things. I mean, I've you know, part of the career I had working with the company that produced Warhorse, you know, there was a moment where we had an actor run and take a jump onto a puppet horse that was held up by two other people and then canter across the stage and then get shot at and fall off the horse. You know, that's the sort of thing that we can make happen. And we have to do that in front of a live audience where it's really hard to hide all of the, you know, I'd love to do some work in the movies sometimes, but my understanding of the little work I have done in the movies is that it's easier to hide things. You can have multiple takes, you can also have shots out of camera. You don't get that in theatre. Mm. It's, you know, unless you're really careful with being creative with the wings, and more creative artists now are exposing the bones of the theatre in their shows. I'm seeing a real upsurge of this. So you lose that wing space, you lose that ability to hide. So it's like asking someone to do the most complicated magic trick and show off at the same time exactly how that magic trick is happening and still have the audience go, wow, how did you do that? And that's the people that we work with. I mean, that's what makes the job so amazing.
That's fascinating, and you can feel the passion come out when you guys describe that. So at the same time, I'm sure you've had incidents when things have gone wrong. What do you do when something goes wrong? Whether it's mindset, maybe. I'm not sure what example you can provide. You don't have to provide one, but is there something that you kind of do that
I think the most important thing when looking at those moments when things don't go the way we had planned them is taking into account the decision-making process that got you to the moment.
Okay.
And really looking and being willing to open that decision-making process back up and break things down. I think too often we look at a situation, we assign blame, whether that blame be a person, a situation, a choice, and we stop. Once we have found the culprit, we stop looking. Mm. And anybody who's ever had a flat tire, and then you think you have taken care of the situation, and then you find out that it wasn't just that one hole.
Right.
It was 16 others. I think we too often do that. We solve what we think the problem is, but we don't exhaust all of the other possibilities and walk back. Mm-hmm. Kind of from a butterfly effect standpoint, have I really gotten to the root cause of that situation? In one of our earlier sessions today, you talked about 5 why. Mm-hmm. You know, are we going through that kind of process? You know, yes, this person made that decision. Why did they make that mm-hmm. decision? Did they have the information they needed mm-hmm. in that moment? Did we train them correctly? Is our training built to account for that moment? Mm-hmm. Did we see that moment? And if we didn't, why didn't we see that mm-hmm. moment? You know, could we have foreseen those? So really being able to dig deeper and dig deeper and dig deeper and just completely exhaust those. And I think, you know, too often, and safety professionals included, I think too often we go, yep, this is what the cause was. Look at that. Mm. All right. We have now mitigated this. Let's move on. Yay for us. Mm. And we forget that there could be other things that led up to that. Very seldom is there a singular cause to any mm-hmm. incident. There is usually a moment that happened that set a series of events in place that eventually led up to that specific incident. So have we walked back far enough in the moment to really understand the core root yeah. cause to what happened?
Yeah.
And no matter how small that incident was, we still need to walk back. Mm. A perfect story to go along with this. Several years ago, we had an incident where some of our parade performers were feeling that their feet were really hot on parade route when they were coming through. And well, you know, in the summertime in Florida, it gets pretty hot. There is asphalt on the ground. It mm. also gets pretty hot. But we really hadn't seen as much of that problem. In walking the situation back, we're looking at the shoes, we're looking at the surface, what changed, what's going on. Well, in that conversation, one of the young ladies in the parade waved to her friend and made a comment about the bachelorette party that they had done a few weeks before. They had all gone and gotten pedicures. Mm. So part of the pedicure is taking the callous skin off of the bottom of your foot. So that exposed their thinner skin onto the shoe, onto the surface, completely changed the situation. And just a simple statement and a simple thing was what the root cause of all of this was. So crazily enough, as we go into the warmer months, we remind performers, hey, if you're going to do this, think about putting an insole in your shoe for the next few days when you're performing, because it's going to change the orientation. And just such a minor thing, mm-hmm. still walking all of those things back, and just really, and it came down to a pedicure.
Right.
So sometimes it's that simple thing that you didn't think about.
How important is it to just have that dialogue and communication? Because, you know, you don't want to wait for something to go horribly wrong before you learn a lesson. There might be a near miss, right? That could have gone terrible if we hadn't done yeah. this or this, or how do you create that environment so that people are, you know, they feel free to speak up, that, you know, I wasn't comfortable doing this because whatever, even though nothing went wrong. Oh,
I think that's something that Anna and I talk a lot about at this conference specifically, is making sure that there is a culture that allows for that conversation mm-hmm. to happen, making sure that everyone feels that they can speak up, making sure there's a vehicle to report those things. And I think sometimes we look at larger companies and we go, of course you have the ability to mm-hmm. do that. But if you look at a smaller place, you also have the ability to have those conversations. And we talk a lot about that communication of the near miss mm-hmm. and how we take that near miss moment and really look at it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've kind of got three three different types of culture, right, you can have. And I know risk professionals talk about this a lot, but you've got the blame culture. Something went wrong, who's to blame? And that is a really attractive and easy culture to have because it's cheap for organizations, right? Something's gone wrong. We need to either fire someone or retrain them. But it's a one thing and it won't actually cost that much money. Then you've got the kind of the more relaxed cultures, the learning culture, where no one is to blame and we're going to learn whatever we can from it. And that sounds on paper like something that's really brilliant. But then what happens if you've got an individual who really did something wrong? Now, very few people will ever make a mistake out of malice, but there's one in a thousand.
Right.
You know, the individual that does turn up to work still drunk from the night before, and it's not because they've got a problem, it's because they're just irresponsible. If you have a learning culture, that individual gets away with it. If you have a just culture, what you're saying is we will learn from anything that happens, but if we find that there is a fault, that someone has maliciously done something, we will also discipline that person. That's a much, much harder culture to have because your organization has to be committed to not finding someone and saying it's your fault, but saying we will learn a much, much broader lesson. Not a lot of artistic directors, chief executives, people in senior positions have had safety training.
Right.
So Brian and I ended up doing the jobs we did and getting training that's particular to that because we're those people that want to know how things work and how we can make things work better. You know, we didn't end up the chief execs of companies because we've learned how to manage huge budgets and all those. It's part of what we do, but it's not, you know, why we end up doing those things. And I think there's a myth that the people above us know exactly what we know. And sometimes they don't. But what they need is the opportunity to learn in a way a bit of what we know. And so the culture is a really good way of getting at it, and the just culture is a really good way because for them, blame culture sounds like the simplest thing. Something's gone wrong in my organization. We need to be seen to be taking action. We're going to discipline that individual. End of story. But actually, just culture could unpack a whole load more problems, but actually we'll end up taking them on a better place, and you have to take them on that journey with you and give them somehow the ability to learn that behind closed doors where they don't feel so exposed.
Do most executives in the industry, do they have some experience coming up the ranks, through the ranks, or does that make a difference in your experience?
They will definitely have had experience in theatre or entertainment, but not necessarily in safety. Just because actually it's quite rare, and it's also a particular discipline that's gained huge traction over the last few years. But it wasn't.
So somebody who started 20 years ago may not have been exposed to the same sorts of things.
It's not to say they don't care, but it's just that they may have a very old-fashioned view of what safety is. You got to be tough. We do it this way. We've always done it this way. That kind of thing. So I'm sure you've had that.
Yeah. I think we hear that phrase often. Of well, when I was doing this, this is how we did it.
Right.
And we often will look at the situation and make the assumption that, well, when we used to do the jobs, this is how it is. And I think we have to be very careful looking at experience. Experience is part of the equation. So if, you know, my experience as a performer is relevant because I can understand the mindset of a performer. But I have to stop and realize I can understand a mindset of a performer based upon the performance that I was doing and the time I was doing it in. And things change. You know, the number of shows, the number of things, the technology, the equipment, all of the parts and pieces change. So we have to understand that our experts are often the people doing the work today. So I can't look at the experience that we have had and make the assumption that it is correct. 9 times out of 10, when we look at some of these problems that we're trying to solve with something that is already open, already running, the thing that we forget to do is to talk to the people that are doing the work. You will see in many industries when they go in, and you will have consultants that come in and look at a thing, and they'll walk through with the executives or the senior leaders, and they'll point and they'll find a thing and say, well, you're doing that wrong. If you talk to the people doing the work, they'll tell you the reason they're doing it, and you know how it takes 3 people to do this job because of these 3 things. That third person may seem like a redundancy to people that aren't familiar, but they need them.
Right.
And so, you know, really understanding and really talking to the folks. Well,
what do you do? Walk me through, what do you do? Okay, why is this thing there? And but doing it to understand, not to judge. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we very often want to make sure that, you know, we gain experience and we never stop learning. You know, we're always students. And, you know, one of the great things about these conferences and these opportunities are the things that even the senior level professionals walk away with something new.
Right.
And every time, every session that I've ever been in, I walk away with some new piece of knowledge. And if I'm in a room and I think I haven't learned something, it's probably because I wasn't listening. So that's something that we all have to remember, is to keep that keep that experience going. And I probably took us down a tangent on it.
Well, I just wanted to make the point that things do go wrong. And I don't want to say, you know, we do the job we do, but we don't always get it right.
And it can't always be right.
Absolutely. And even if you get every new miss and you have every plan, something can still happen. And because it's the industry we work in, often our failures or our incidents are very, very public. Mm. And I remember, you know, when I was quite junior in the role of safety, I was working for a company, and I got a phone call that nobody wants to get, that a huge structure that we'd been working on had fallen. It was being built on a part of a building, almost like a mezzanine kind of platform level, and it had fallen off of this. It was a structure that, I don't know what this is in old money, but it was 15 meters high and a meter wide. It was terribly designed. And it had fallen and bounced off a roof of a neighboring building and crashed into a car park. And I turn up onto the site to look at a wreckage, and nobody was hurt, but it was a miracle, because a moment before, somebody had been standing in the spot where that had fallen, and they had moved out of the way because they were trying to take a phone call from their girlfriend, apparently, and they didn't want to be seen by a camera. And it was the sheer luck of them deciding that they were trying to be naughty that saved their life.
Wow.
And there's all sorts of things that go through your mind at that exact moment. When you look at that, the first thing is, I want to be anywhere else, and I want to be anyone else. And that was the first thing that went through my mind, right. And that this is my fault. Mm. And then this weird thing happens when you say, and I'm going to stay here and figure out how to clear this up.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking.
Right.
But you know, it doesn't mean that you're being a safety professional doesn't mean you're not human. Mm. And there are dark days, and there are days when you think, you know, those are the ones I can talk to you about, because you've seen, these are the ones that people will have seen. So.
And if things go wrong, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was your fault, or that you did something, you made a good decision based on the information you had available to you, other people were involved, if you tested it, you know, then... Yeah, you're in a better place. But if you unilaterally took some action or some decision, then that's a concern. But,
yeah, and then sometimes it's, you know, well, we're in an industry where there's a lot going on. Mm. So did we give it enough attention? What does enough attention look like? And when safety is somewhere in your job title and something goes wrong and someone gets injured, it's really hard not to start second guessing yourself.
Right.
And there does have to be a moment of you saying, you know, my job is now how to fix this problem and how to work it through.
Right.
Then it's important to take a breath. And then just start to work on, just start to pull it apart and work on what you do. But those few moments, you can take people on a journey with you, or you can wreck it. You know, and again, it's like, whose fault? Don't ask for, that's not the first question.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Is everyone okay? Great. How do we make the area safe? How do we then start to unpick that and work the problem? But it's a really delicate time.
Mm.
And those are the terrible moments.
Right.
Yeah. And this is a very small industry. Almost everyone in the industry is connected in some way, shape, or form to everyone else. And as an industry, we have had some very public tragedies. Mm-hmm. And every time one of those tragedies happens, you look at what can we learn from this moment. We reach out to our families in other venues and in other places, and take care of them as humans first. And then look at what do we know? What do we know? What can we learn? And Anna and myself and quite a lot of folks that are involved with USITT really want to make sure that we're creating the environment that the safety professionals and the safety leaders in the industry have the ability to talk and learn with each other and learn from those issues and look at what great programs look like. how did you put that program together? How did you look at doing this effect, this stunt, this thing? And we all know with intellectual property and things that are out there that there are only certain things that we can openly discuss. But how can we take those moments and how can we reach out to our partners in the industry and share the success, but at the same time share the opportunities when we do learn those things? Because if we're not opening ourselves to be able to say, I did a lot of investigation of this moment. I looked at this thing. The teams looked at this. We found here is where the error occurred. And we want to make sure that no one else is making that exact same mistake.
I wanted to touch on a couple of things before we go to some questions. One was mindset of performers. Do you have this issue where, like in athletics, where you know somebody gets injured, maybe it's a head injury, and the player just wants to continue playing because you know that's what, just what you do? And I'm wondering if you have a similar thing in the theater world where performers, whether it's for reasons of their resume or the prestige of a particular role or a stunt or whatever, they want to do a thing, and you just have to say, you can't do it.
I think absolutely. Performers are performers because that's what they do. That's who they are. And they don't want to let down the audience. They don't want to let down their fellow performers. They don't want to let down the crew. They don't want to let down their choreographer. They want to carry through. And I think sometimes what we have the capacity to do is convince ourselves that we're fine. And we look at a certain level of discomfort and go, I have this level of discomfort because I'm a dancer, because I'm a stilt walker, because this is what I do. So it's okay. Mm-hmm. So I keep going. So I think the mindset of the performer is much like the mindset of an athlete. Mm-hmm. And I think looking at performers as athletes and looking at the entertainment industry the way we do it in athletics, we look at the crews that unload trucks and set up arena shows and look at what they accomplish in the span of time that they do, the level of physical exertion that they put in there, I would put against any athlete anywhere if you look at all of those things. And I would love to at someday do studies about these kind of things and compare what it looks like in the theatrical world versus an athletic world, because I think there are a lot of parallels and we can learn a lot from each other.
I think that, you know, this is where us psychologists come in, because it's easy to think, you know, the performer is getting into their zone, they're getting into character, and there's things that they don't need us to bother them with. And sometimes they're human and they're terrified, and sometimes they do want to know more. And I remember, you know, even the most famous people, there's a thing in the UK called the Brit Awards, which is a pop, it's a huge show, it's broadcast live on television, and the big acts of the time will go on and they'll do whatever it is that they're going to prepare for. And at the time, Gwen Stefani was going through her Queen of Hearts, Alice in Wonderland phase, and there was a really amazing piece of automation, and she basically was, I think it was, getting into these cards that were going to then open up, and I think either ascend or she was going to come down in them. But anyway, it was a big lift moment. And you know, there's this performer who's world famous, she's got one of those huge entourages around her, and she's on stage going through all these things, and the tour guide was sort of saying to her, and then you'll step into this and you'll do that, and she's like, is this safe? Will this hold me? And so the other safety director that I was working with said, let me show you something, and he opened up some of the trappings around the inside, and he showed her the mechanisms. And you've got Gwen Stefani kind of looking at a lift mechanism, because she's going to be the one that's going to be in it. So you've got that mindset. Sometimes performers don't want to know. They're like, if you tell me it's safe, that's all I need to know. But they're also human. Mm. And that sort of thing can really help them get into the space that they need to get in. Yeah. But I don't know about you, Brian, but I'm always learning what a performer needs. Yeah. And sometimes you can plant a seed of worry that then grows in their mind, and you realize, oh, I've created a monster. Right. I was trying to reassure you, and I've given you too much information. Mm. So it's that delicate balance of you're going to be safe, and now I've given you too much information, and that's all you're thinking about. Mm.
Yeah, and we can't make those assumptions. I think also when we look at that mindset, we talk about the physicality, and we don't stop to understand the emotional piece of it. If you look at the performance world, whether it's dancing as a couple or on stage, very often you're involved in creating a relationship with somebody that gets to be a very intimate relationship, and you have that relationship for a short period of time, and then that person might be gone from your life because you're moving on to the next city, moving on to the next show. And so from an emotional standpoint, the cycle that a performer may go through dealing with that is something that we've got, I think we've got a lot of opportunity. The creation of an intimacy coordinators, which is now happening in a lot of spaces, helps with those intimacy moments.
Yeah, that blew me away yesterday. Yeah. I mean, I'm a complete neophyte for all this stuff, you know, but how does that work? You know, intimacy in
absolutely.
Theater.
Yeah. Well, and you look at that, and the role of an actor is to bring people into that moment and to feel. And so if we have a couple on stage that is displaying this very, very emotional moment, there's some level of connection that they have to that. And you can't just walk away from that and think you're not going to carry a piece of it. So looking at how we look at not just the physical health of our performers, but also the emotional and mental health of our performers as well, is the next step on the journey. We talk about safety and health as being a cultural journey, and as we do better with different things, as we move further down the pathway, the next door opens up and we look at the next opportunity. So we're continuing down that, and I think that's one of the next areas that we'll be looking into a lot more in the future.
Yeah, I think that idea of performer and athlete is an interesting one, because I think the best people that work as safety directors are actually like coaches. You know, that we are trying to create the environment around which that person can give their best performance, whether that best performance is throwing a javelin, you know, competing in the Tour de France, that I know is very close to both of your hearts, or, you know, or giving their ultimate moment in Hamlet or something, you know. And we're trying to just create that. And that may be, you know, from something as simple as, you know, I worked on a musical, and one of the cast members needed their costume wrapped around them in a very, very particular way. And if that didn't happen in the same way every night, that could be disastrous for the production. It's a small thing, but it was a key safety moment. This has to happen in the same way, which means we have to have the same wardrobe person, and they have to do it. They have to knock on the door in the same way, and everything, you know, from that moment to making sure that the automation works, or making sure that when you set someone on fire, you know, you do it in the correct way.
When you set someone on fire, you do it in the correct way.
And don't forget to put them out.
Yeah.
Very important step.
Right. I wanted to touch on one other area, and then we can open up for questions. And that was around looking at risks when you're doing something new, or the performance is doing something new. I find that fascinating, because in a lot of the risk work that happens in major organizations or small businesses, it's probably been done before, right? But I'm fascinated by how you think through risks when, I don't know, you're sending the Mars rover, you know, into Mars. It's something that's never been done before. And I think that thought process is fascinating, because if you do that, then if there are some methods or some tools to do that, then you can help not just performances occur in extraordinarily new ways, but I think there's some transferable skills. So I'd be very keen to hear your thoughts on looking at risks when something is like completely new.
Well, I think the most important thing is we've talked about process, and you know, thinking about it, not to go into the math category, because you know, no math whiz here, but I think the parallel is there's always an equation. There's always an equation to look at. You know, the answers are not necessarily going to be the same every time, but the process by which we get to the answer can be the same. So it doesn't matter if it's new. The steps we take will still need to look at those things. And if we start with the familiar, with your example of the Mars rover, you know, the only difference between sending something to the moon, which we've done before, is we've changed some of the variables. So which variables have we changed? Which ones do we know are the controllable variables and the factors that we know about? So we've got a comfort level with those things, and then look at the ones that we've now made the shift. And so breaking it down into those smaller components and those smaller controllable parts is very important, because you don't get so overwhelmed with the enormity of the new task. You start looking at those familiar moments, and then by the time you get to the moment that is unfamiliar, you may have learned a lot of different things about what's going to be happening, what you're going to need to look at, and, you know, always making sure you're bringing in the experts, because if there's something new, there's probably somebody out there who's experimenting with it, has looked at it, and don't be afraid to reach out and talk to that person.
I think that's a great point. I sometimes use a phrase, I talked a bit about black swans, which are these like completely new things that throw everybody off. But sometimes organizations think that something's a black swan, but it's not. It's a blind spot. Mm-hmm. It's something that in the organization, there isn't really any expertise, but somebody somewhere knows something about that thing. So bring that person in and figure it out. Yeah.
I think I want to talk about two things. I want to talk about the naive expert and ideal conditions. These are my two takeaway points for people. So first of all, it takes a village to work on a problem. So have some fun and get that village together. You know, it's easy to say it's a safety issue, so let's bring a safety person in. The best conversations are when you get everyone around the room, but bring in, you know, this is a phrase that I've been given, and I think it was coined by Duncan Wardle, who does this amazing TED talk on innovation. Mm-hmm. I can give you the link for the show notes. But he said basically, when you've got a room full of people that know exactly what the subject is, bring in someone who is an expert in something else. Mm-hmm. And the naive part of that naive expert is they're not the expert in your particular field. And what's good about them is their fresh eyes, mm-hmm. and their fresh eyes in something, you know, that they've never experienced before. So they will find the holes, the obvious holes that you've missed because you've been doing it for so long. You know, so, you know, okay, we're going to set someone on fire. How do we put them out? Like, it sounds obvious, but you might have missed that. I mean, I'm being a bit facetious in that. And the final point is ideal conditions. So one of the mistakes I've made in my career is looking at what I've got to work with and imagining that is sufficient. And sometimes when you've got a brand new project, forget about what you've got as your resources and imagine what perfect resources would look like. And then look at what you've got and go, okay, do these match up? What is the gap? But sometimes I've gone, well, this is what we've got. We're going to have to work with that. And that was when you need to take that step back and go, we need more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the we need more conversation is very important, especially when you're talking these giant grand ideas. And we started talking about the things that we want to look at. We want to say yes. And the reality is there are sometimes moments that we can't figure out how to say yes. Mm-hmm. And in those moments, the important thing is to be honest about what it would take. And oftentimes when we define what it would take to bring this moment to life, we don't have the funding, we don't have the time, we don't have the capacity. So sometimes the best thing in the world to do is say, here is how we get there. And folks may decide, you know what, it's not worth that to get to that place. And I know we both think it's very important to never say no and to always be very honest about the reality is we can figure out a way to do it. Mm-hmm. Can we make that into a reality with the resources that we have? And you know, one of the things I just made a quick note about here is you said have fun, and we want to always have fun with the moments. And I think it's very important for any industry, any part of the world, is to remember that what we do is fun. We all came into this field because it's exciting, because of what we get to do. And those moments are amazing. And never stop looking at the work that we produce, never stop looking at it, and look at it from the perspective of someone else. Mm-hmm. Last year we had a retreat in Anaheim, and Anna had never been to a Disney park before. So one of the most incredible moments for me during that retreat was looking at product that I had worked on through her eyes and being able to see it from the perspective that I sometimes forget to look at it. So it's one of those, always remember to step back and look at that thing from the perspective of someone who's never seen it before. We can work on those things for months. We can work on those things sometimes for years. And by the time it goes out, we've seen it so many times, we stop understanding how incredible it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, never forget to have the fun and remember to look at it through the same eyes of those who've never seen it before.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, I'd like to get some questions from the audience about anything that you've heard for Anna or Brian or myself, and we'll see if we can answer them.
So anything at all? Yes, sir.
A lot of managing risk in theater is based off of a certain effect on stage or in front of the audience. And in some cases, that effect doesn't always fire off right on cue. And then you have unmanaged risk. And was there ever a time in which you've had moments like that where an effect didn't go off on cue and now you have potential?
So the question was, a lot of the managing of risk in theater is about managing effects, and sometimes those effects that are desired, they don't happen right away, and therefore, how do you manage those kinds of, or look at those kinds of situations, if I got that correct?
I'll tell a really quick story, which is kind of to that point. So we had a show called Hot House, and in Hot House there's a very famous exploding cigar. And the armory department where I'd been working had created this amazing prop, which was essentially a smokable cigar with a small pyrotechnic in the top. And the pyrotechnic was fired by pressing your thumb in an indent so that you could smoke it, not set it off, but you had to press it. And the actor had to meet a very, very specific mark so that he could fire the pyrotechnic in a very, very safe area. The actor chose one night to walk to the front of the stage, pointed the cigar like a weapon at a lady in the front row, fired the pyrotechnic and set fire to her fur coat. So sometimes it's the risk, it happens, it just doesn't happen the way you think it does. And, you know, that there's an idea that a show has a momentum and it's just going to keep going. And actually the truth is we can stop it any time we want to. What you've got to do is have brave people who work with you who know exactly when to say hold and to surround that particular thing and then manage that risk that's in there. So just because you've got an unfired pyro doesn't mean you have to continue the show and tell the actors to stay away from that point. You can stop the show. The show can then carry on 10 minutes down the line when you've made that thing safe. But you don't want that unmanaged risk to happen and you haven't actually thought that through. So when you have an area of particular risk in a show, do some thought experiments. What would happen if that was to happen in the middle of the show? Now, you might not get to, okay, my pyro doesn't fire or it falls in the wrong way. You know, you're not going to solve every single individual problem, but just start working through that process and building that muscle of what if, so that your teams are actually ready to respond when something does happen to manage that. So that might be, you know, we've got some teams that will create a safe space. We've got teams that will bring in a fire curtain. We've got teams that will manage the front of house expectations. But, you know, just do those thought experiments. And you can do them at any time, and you can do them sitting around a table. So start with that is my kind of opener.
Yeah. And the important thing to remember is failure is always an option. You know, anytime you work with any effect, anything, any cue, sometimes things just don't work right. They lose a connection somewhere. One piece of equipment that's supposed to talk to another that has worked perfectly every time suddenly decides that today's the day that, you know, we're just not going to talk to each other. So, you know, like Anna said, making sure that you've thought through, what do I do in those moments? And make sure that your actors also know the plan. Your performers also know, if this happens, I need you to change your behavior. If there's an effect that is in a certain point of the stage and everybody knows, stay clear of this area until after this part. Once it's fired, okay, we're good to go. Does everyone know whether it fired or not? Is somebody going to be getting close to that thinks it's safe? So making sure that you go through the what-if moments of all of those different things. And, you know, and not to get so bogged down in the possibility and the scenarios, but making those decisions of where can things go wrong? What's the probability of those things going wrong? And then addressing those things accordingly.
You know, and the funny thing is you often take the audience on your journey with you, particularly in live theatre. I've been in shows that we've had to stop the show and 10, 20 minutes later, sometimes half an hour, started it back up again to a thunderous applause because they were there in that moment. I was there the night that this happened. You know, I worked for many years in the National Theatre, and no one is going to mind me saying this. The Olivier lift was the most unpredictable thing imaginable. And there were some shows that we were just hoping, we were fingers crossed until we got it fixed. There was another show we did, it was just unbelievable, where we had lots of tables and chairs all chained together. And as part of the show, they were lifted up to form huge strands. And every night, one of them would get tangled tangled, and sometimes it would get tangled in a particular way that you had to stop the show, untangle it, and bring it down again, because we had performers going up and climbing up. 19 shows in a row we stopped the show, because the safety is important. We fixed the problem, but we didn't know that problem was going to be there when we designed it. You just get used to it, and the audience, they loved it, so it's okay to stop something. That's the important thing, is getting everyone home safe and getting them in to do it again the next day.
Yeah, the loudest applause I ever got as a performer is when I fell down on stilts. And when I got back up, that was the applause moment. You can do all the fun stunts and all the fun things in the world, but sometimes the audience is like, oh, okay, he's okay. That was more important than the, quote, show moment.
Any other questions? Yes.
Can y'all walk us through a day in your life at your job?
So the question is, can you walk us through a day in your life in your job?
I would love if I could walk you through a day in my life. I would have to pick which one, because I can honestly say I've been in the role I'm in now for over 10 years, and no day has been like any other day, which is pretty amazing. But a day in the life really is, you know, stopping to look at which things I'm going to be looking at today. We run an audit program, so a large portion of what I do is really looking at, you know, helping to look at the operating procedures and how we are running things and confirming that we're running things the way we're supposed to be running them. And that's the day when nothing else is going on, which is maybe happened twice in that period of time. But really, my day is all about helping the production teams and helping all of the other folks connect the dots. So it's really a lot of what are we doing today? Which incredible concept am I going to be able to look at that I wish I could talk about and tell everybody about, but I can't, but it's going to be amazing and the wait times are going to be ridiculous. So I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I think you have to be very self-motivated, very disciplined to work in safety, because unlike many other jobs, you're kind of inserting yourself into meetings. You're going to design presentations to do a lot of listening and then create your own workflow. So sometimes you'll say, this particular show has been managed very well, and I'm going to step back. There isn't anything there that I think that we haven't done lots of times before. That's usually when you say that there's something else will happen. But sometimes there's a show where there's something that's brand new and you know that there's going to be research. So a large part of the job is about research, pulling together information and data. And then there is, you know, I agree with you, there hasn't been a single day where anything is the same. There's that question that'll drop in, those emails that I'd just like to ask you about. And I've had all sorts of, you know, we want to put snakes on a stage. Animals are always a good one. We want to have X animal in a show, you know, and then you start, okay, well, what do I know about those particular animals? You know, I've worked with rabbits and ducks and geese and pigeons, and, you know, pigeons are very stressed animals. if you want to have a pigeon in a show, you need two. Because a pigeon will always assume that the other pigeon is the one that's going to be in the show, and that will calm them down. If you only have one pigeon, they always assume it's them, and they're the ones that get very, very stressed. So that's kind of one thing.
I know people like that.
Yeah, yeah. But they always say, I love the fact that a pigeon will always think, oh, it's the other one that's going to get picked and not me. So they're very
that
humble.
Happens in meetings.
Yeah, that's very true. So yeah, it's going to be different depending on any show. And then there is Fridays at 5 o'clock. Just as you think, I think I've had a successful week, I'm winding down, and then the phone rings, and you always pick it up, and it's usually when, you know, we can't do the show tonight because X has just failed, or this has just happened, and it's usually the thing where everyone is that you need to speak to is also heading on their way home, and you're pulling everyone back in, but that's the fun stuff. Yeah. That's the fun stuff.
It really is. I mean, I don't want to say it gets fun when things go wrong, but it gets exciting when we have a problem to solve, because that's really what we do. We came into this world because we are problem solvers, and we like putting the puzzles together, and we like to be able to say, yeah, it works, and we made it happen. So when those moments do happen, it's always fun to figure out okay, how do we get there?
Mm-hmm. And it's also sometimes you work, you know, I work with some brilliant people, and sometimes all I'm doing is telling them that they know what they're talking about. You know, I'm not the one who's inventing, you know, when it comes to dropping rocks from the ceiling, I didn't invent that mechanism. Mm. But I was able to say to that individual, you're smart, and as far as I can see, you figured this out exactly the way I would want it to be figured out. And that's always a joy when someone's, can I show you something? What do you think about this? They're the best conversations to have.
Yeah, and like we've talked about, you know, the expert is always in the room, and sometimes they don't realize they're the expert. And being able to have that conversation, okay, what do you want to do? What could go wrong? What are we worried about? What are this? And a good portion of what we do is really asking those questions. And sometimes it's really important to ask the question you know the answer to, because you give that other person the opportunity to tell you that they also know the answer to that. And it doesn't matter if we have the answers. It really matters if those folks have gone through the thought process of knowing that. And if you have that relationship and you help build those folks up and take them on the journey with you, then they'll continue to come back and they'll continue to bring those challenges and continue to go, okay, I did this sketch. Here's what I want to do. And so many great conversations begin with the, here's what I want to do. And then you start looking at the sketches and figuring out and asking questions and pointing at things and going, well, what about, and then taking through all of those, you know, amazing twists and turns that we see.
Right. I'm not sure how we're doing for time, but do you think we can take one more question?
Absolutely.
Yeah? Sir.
So in the context of the incident where you said the actor accidentally set fire to a front row patron, what kind of conversations occur immediately after an incident like that? And then also the conversations that would have to occur immediately following the show, like with your professional staff, and what you have to talk about to kind of prevent something like that from happening again.
So the question was, in that case where Anna talked about the actor accidentally setting fire to the patron in the front row, what was the conversation right after or immediately after that incident? And then following the incident, what was the conversation around understanding why that happened?
So I think I'll talk in general terms, because actually in that moment, because the individual in the front row was fine, there was a lot of laughter backstage. The first thing you want to do when something happens on stage is, you know, if it depends on whether a hold has been called or not. And we're going to actually talk about this a little bit in one of our sessions. But I like to try and teach something that the military use, which is called Sergeant Major Eats Sugar Cookies. And I'm probably going to remember all these wrong. But the first thing is situation. What has just happened? And you need to be very clear about what has just happened, because sometimes it's the pebble that's telling you that an avalanche is happening. So it may just be a pyro that's gone wrong, or it may be a bolt has dropped, which means something else is about to go wrong. And those are terrifying moments. So what is my mission? My mission is to, first of all, ensure life safety. And we should never forget that. It's not, you know, someone said brilliantly in this conference, it's not the show must go on, it's the show will go on at some point, and hopefully with everyone there intact. And so we must think that, preserve life safety, and then see if we can continue the show. So execution then is what do we want to happen? So if everyone's safe, we want the show to continue, and we want the best version of that show to continue. Now, that may be that we have to pull certain things out of that show. And then situation, mission, execution, Sergeant Major, eat sugar cookies. So then we're looking at what services do we have to help us get to that point. So who do I have in my immediate team? Now, the one thing that is wonderful about theatre is the roles and responsibilities are usually pretty well defined. You have a stage manager, you have a stage carpenter, you have a TD. So pull those individuals in, get your quick experts. And sometimes that's a very quick call on comms. Can so-and-so come to the stage, please? And I've been backstage when they've called the safety person to the stage as well. And then finally, you know, what's the communication? And that is so, so important. If two people have a hurried conversation backstage about how they're going to fix something, how do you quickly tell everybody? And if you can't tell everyone you need to stop until you can. So those are kind of the immediate things. And then, you know, you notice that I didn't say who messed up. Because the minute you start asking that as the first question, why did that happen? Whose fault was that? You've lost the trust. Once the show is over, the debrief is really, really important. But it's also very, very important to remember that people sitting around that table could be feeling tired, probably feeling really frustrated that something went wrong, could be feeling, if it was a serious incident, panicked or have a lot of emotion. So the first question to ask in a debrief is, how's everyone doing? How are you? Get them just talking, you know, and then tell us in your words what just happened. And just get them to talk. You're not asking any specific questions, and then you can start unpicking. But the first question is, how's everyone doing? So I hope that may have gone some way to answering your question.
Yeah, and I think we have two ears, two eyes, and one mouth, and we should use them in that ratio. When things do happen, the most important thing we can do is listen and give folks the opportunity to talk and to begin with, how is everybody? Everybody all right? Because I think too often we do jump to that blame moment and we put up the poster backstage that says, please don't light the audience on fire. Great. We've just created a policy. Problem solved. Policies do not solve problems. Policies are only as good as the people who follow them, and people cannot follow policies unless they are aware they have been put in place and appropriately trained, and those things have been appropriately documented. And I know I'm talking a lot about different kind of things, but even in the smallest theater, those things are important. Folks who know what is expected of them. Expectations are one of the things that we really, really have to set. And then we have to give people the opportunity to live up to those expectations, and they often will. People want to understand what's expected of them. I have two children, and I think the biggest lesson that they have taught me is, A, have fun, because that's the whole point in life, you know, to have fun and enjoy being here. And then also they have taught me that sometimes I do a terrible job of defining what I need. Children will often listen and do exactly what you ask them to do, and then we get frustrated because they just did exactly what I told them to do. So, you know, keep that in mind, and, you know, as you're doing those things, make sure the explanations are there, the conversations are there. And as Anna talked about the debrief, I think one of the things that we as an industry can do better on is having that post-production moment, having that after-action moment, even in the shows that go perfectly, because everybody knows that happens. Do we sit down after the fact, and instead of immediately, you know, talking about how great the cast party was, who did what, you know, whatever, do we sit down and go, okay, what are all of the things we did right? And start with what are all of the things we did right? And let's celebrate those great things, what happened here, what did there. Let those kudos come. Let folks enjoy what they did right. And then ask the questions, okay, what opportunities did we have? And I never want to say, what did we do wrong? Because we might have not have known that it wasn't going to work out. But, you know, what did we learn? What did we learn on this? What do we need to remember? I used to make a joke about going into several seasons of things. In my office used to be a tab that had the top 10 things we are going to mess up this season. And it was hanging in my office for years. And I think the best season we ever had, we only messed up 7 of 10. So even though we knew going into every season what things we were going to likely screw up, those things still happened. So having that opportunity, having that, you know, creating that space to learn and take those opportunities and grow and understand that of that list of 10 things, maybe 2 of those things were truly controllable. So understand those things are there and embrace them. Embrace the impossible.
I think a quick point about debriefs as well is don't ask people how things went, because they'll go around the room and they'll all say fine and you'll get no information. Ask interesting and challenging questions. What was your favorite part about this show? One of my favorite questions to ask people is if your show or your safety culture was an animal, what would it look like? Because it's really hard for people to give you the answer that they think you want. And it just, it gets a bit of a lot. I mean, you know, we're not talking after a serious incident. Obviously, that's a whole different story. But, you know, well, I think our show was like a bear because it slept for a bit, but then it woke up and got really interesting. You know, well, then you've got a conversation starter. So it's worth exploring some different questions.
I love that. I'm going to use that in my world. Any other questions before we look to wrap things up? Well, I have to say, I think this was a very successful experiment. So thank you, Brian and Anna, for your time. Was there anything that you wanted to mention before we wrap things up?
Oh, well, I just want to say thank you for coming and doing this experiment with us. One of the things that we've been really focused on in this organization with USITT is things exactly like this. How do we extend the conversation? How do we extend the message? And I think this gives us a great opportunity to take the conversation out of the room that we're in and bring it into another space and maybe make some folks think in a different way. So thanks for the opportunity.
No, it's absolute pleasure.
Yeah, I would completely echo that. It's, you know, it was having you, Ben, come and talk in front of some theatre professionals today. I think it was amazing. I think it was a real two-way conversation because I know that you said to me afterwards that you enjoyed it, but I know that you were introducing concepts today to an industry that was more unfamiliar with them as well. So I think it's been a really great day, and thanks for being brave enough to just try it, flying across the world and just trying this out.
No, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. We'll wrap it up here, and I know my listeners will thoroughly enjoy this as well, as I hope you all have in the audience. But thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed that. Links and other good stuff are in the show notes, as usual. And if you are a fan of the All Things Risk podcast, a great way to support us is to leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. It helps us get noticed by others. It's free and quick, and it really helps us out tremendously. We are grateful for all of your positive reviews and feedback. And any feedback that you have, please let me know. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is a great way to do that. If you've not yet subscribed to the show, or if you want to check out all our back catalog, simply go to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. And that's it for now. We will be back with our next episode in 2 weeks' time. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.